Italia, in Italia.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Backjack, the Samurai Jack Rewatch podcast. I'm Andy.
And I'm Matt.
And we'll be your hosts walking you through every single episode of one of the best damn cartoon series to come out in the early 2000s, Samurai Jack. Today we're going into a samurai called Jack, which is where Jack pops into the future immediately following his epic combat with Aku in the last episode. So I believe that without further ado, Matt has a brief synopsis of the episode for us.
Exiting the portal in time, Aku used to exact his ultimate vengeance, our hero is forced to cope with a world where that evil is law. When confronted with the topsy-turvy fate of his home, can the newly aliased Jack find his way, even with the help of a familiar friend?
That was good. I like that. That covered everything, except, well, the dogs and the dig and the crystals.
They're the familiar ones.
And the cute triclopsian waitress and the... Right, okay. So when we open the episode here, Jack literally pops out of time. Bam! And apparently he pops out of space as well because he's hundreds of feet up in the air and falling.
Yep.
And he's falling into a traffic pattern reminiscent of Star Wars Episode 2, or perhaps if you go a little farther back than that, The Fifth Element. So we have this great cityscape with crisscrossing patterns of multi-layer flying car traffic, which has been a really cool sci-fi trope for a long time. But now Jack has to deal with this shit. So here he goes. Ah, thud! Runs into one. And now he has to do this awesome video game sequence where he's getting shot at. And, you know, there's people apparently in the future, you know, it's all road rage.
Well, yeah, I was about to say, that guy with the rockets seemed like he had a little road rage.
In Russia, they have dash cams. In Aku's universe, they have rocket launchers.
Yeah.
So a little rougher than Russia, I'd say.
At the central hub.
And that's apparently the name of the city, the central hub. Like, it's non-uniquely named. It has a function. But we don't find that out for a minute until we talk to the awesome street people. But Jack is falling through traffic, doing his best not to die. And I think it's also clear at this point that Jack is surrounded with what I like to call the Hollywood bubble, which is sort of, you know how you have noise gates on microphones like we're using? Like, the louder you scream, it'll gate it down for every 10 decibels. It only increases volume 1 decibel. Okay. Hollywood superheroes have this bubble around them. So, like, the harder, they only take like less than 1/10 or even 1/100th of the actual damage a real fleshy human would take from falling or being hit or being thrown or, you know, being thrown backwards at roughly 50, 60 miles an hour by the big bad and then crushing stone as they fly through a pillar or something.
Yeah.
Which would, you know, the pillar wouldn't move. An actual human would just turn to paste.
Right. Against the pillar. Right.
But not a Hollywood hero. The bubble protects them. This is in every single Hollywood movie you've ever seen. Go look for it. Once you see it, it's like orange and blue. Once you see it, you can't not see
it. Oh, yeah, yeah. Every time I see, you know, cement yielding to a person, I'm like, yikes.
Like, grinds along the ground. Like, what is it made out of, like, dried mud? Like,
welcome to Styrofoam City.
It burns and melts. And Jack is like, once he figures out this is a hostile environment, he doesn't fuck around. He immediately whips out the sword and starts trying to defend himself.
Right.
And it cuts to apparently a police vehicle, and there's the initials PAB on their outfit.
Yeah, whatever that might mean.
Any speculation on that?
I mean, you know, I can throw Aku into the A, but I can't figure out the other two syllables no matter what, or the other two
police
letters.
Of Aku's, I don't know. I can't.
Yeah, it's hard
and
to say.
Any of our listeners have an idea what PAB stands for on this officer's thing, let us know. So he, like, goes to town on the car that he's on. He literally just effortlessly slices through. This is the first time we see what this blade is really capable of.
Right.
Because really he only used it to attack Aku before. But this way we're seeing that the blade is proving to be almost lightsaber in quality.
Yeah.
Boom. Right through. Boom. No problem. Slices the front end of the car off. Slices off the ailerons, I guess.
Yeah.
And all while he's being shot at by the cops. And the cop goes down, causing Samurai Jack to fall.
Yeah, it almost, the way he attacks it, It's like he's regarding the car itself as a beast of burden. Like he chopped its head off and then chopped off its legs, you know, like.
That's true. He chopped off what it looked like would have been vulnerable to him.
Right.
If this thing had been alive, or if it was a cart of some sort.
Yeah, like he was trying not to kill the driver. Mm-hmm. He just wanted to kill the thing he was riding on.
Yeah, he easily could have just stabbed right through the windshield and killed whoever was inside and then taken over the thing, maybe.
It's what Anakin would have done.
Yeah, he's still very ethical here. Like, you see these right from his first combat seconds, as far as he's concerned, after he's fought Aku. He's like, oh, I don't want to kill people. These are people in what's happening now. It's hard for him to even conceptualize where he is. But, so he falls down into what apparently is this gutter full of trash.
Oh, yes. In the cities of Aku's Earth, the streets were unfresh with garbage.
Unfresh. I like that word. That's great. Are you feeling unfresh?
Jack starts off right in the thick of it, and we see the incredibly inefficient trash compacting machines rolling through, and, I don't know. He's already faced somebody with a rocket launcher. So how much worse can this trash compactor possibly be? But I think the trash compactors, don't they also shoot missiles or something like that?
I don't think they were shooting at him. It was just the environmental menace. Like it wasn't designed to attack anything. It was designed to inefficiently crush garbage.
Oh yeah. And he catches a ride on it, really.
Yeah. And does that cool thing. He does that water wheel thing that stuntmen do. There used to be a thing where I think it was like an old cowboy movies or something. They're fighting around a mill and the good guy or the bad, like catches onto the water wheel and like catches a ride up on the water wheel. And we see that pop up in movies from time to time. And Jack pulls that maneuver, which is kind of cool, with these awesome big spikes that are also inefficient for crushing garbage, and grabs onto one and rides it up top. And obviously he's not thinking, I'm going to kill this thing. He just wants to get out of the way and get his bearings, which he does with elan and flamboyance, because that's what Jack does. And all of his training leading up to this led to this. His training with the Shaolin and jumping around on moving things, his training on horseback for the balance, like all of this stuff that we saw him do immediately comes into play. His first action sequence, boom, he uses all of it.
Yep. So he grabs onto the spike and he gets carried back up and he lands next to a group of multiracial loiterers that charm Jack with a delightfully stereotypical banter.
I can't even repeat this. Like, yo, Jack, that was awesome. You've done this.
Honestly, I could never hope.
It's like whammy jammy this thing.
Yeah, awesome. Like they.
Oh, no! Yahoo! Yeah!
Oh, that was bad, man.
Yo, Jack, that was some awesome show.
I never peer to pump moves like that, Jack.
What? Jack was all ricocheting and jumpadelic.
Here's Zach, yeah, prodigiously acrobatastic.
Word. But then, like, when Jack pulled that Swiss on, it was all like, swing, swat, swoop, man, right through the car. Swick attack, whack, and spawn on the back, Jack.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was all, shoo, boo, man, eat that, flunky crunker.
Yo, then my man just, like, lands all coolie style, like, no sweating, chum.
But then that gutter will come out of Rama Lama Lama, and the trash is all munching and crunching and snack mixing.
One of them fat, super casual, fragilistic, tistic tie, yo.
Yeah, but Jack's just like, word, let me get some tie, grab, I'm out, yo.
Thank you.
They got into it a little bit, the voice actors, you can tell.
I gotta wonder how much was scripted. Like, how much did they just make up off the top of their heads because they're funny people?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think what we have here is, you know, sort of when you let your voice actors sort of come up with their own stuff here. Not fully improv, but come on. This couldn't have been in the script.
I think they probably was like, each of these three voices expounds upon this particular action.
This
talk about
part
when Jack
of the
did
action,
this.
Right, yep.
And then here's 3 minutes worth of tape. Just go crazy. Give me three different versions of this.
Yeah.
So they probably just let them go through it like five or six times until they had gotten down their pattern.
Yep.
And then they use those takes. Like that would be how I would do it. But I mean, it was amazing. And this is the coolest thing. They managed to do this. It didn't feel, it felt ethnic. It felt what they were doing. Like, this is obviously kind of like street lingo, but right. It didn't feel racist. It didn't feel like they were doing this exploitively. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't feel like any of this was meant to be like, oh, we're going to make fun of those poor urban people now. It was a Hollywood shortcut to give them this sort of jive. But
in that also, they kind of wanted to, it was a very easy way to explain why he picked the name Jack later.
Yeah. Jack is an old term for calling anybody. That goes back to like ancient Britain. All the old heroes were Jack. You know, if you didn't know the guy's name, it was Jack. You know, yeah. Jack the Ripper, Spring and that, Heel you know, Jack,
that,
you know.
That stuck around all the way for 3,000 years or something.
Yeah.
Whatever this is.
I have to imagine also that Aku's empire doesn't change terribly much. Once it's there, it's there. And Aku is eternal. So he has this, of all the weird things, he has this strange stabilizing effect on society.
Well, like
he builds it and it stays and that's it.
He forces everything in culture to be shaped like his head. So how much can it really change?
Yeah, exactly. He's unchanging. Therefore, society is unchanging. So there. So after these awesome street guys who are hanging out, by the way, by a lamppost that looks like Aku's head.
Yeah.
They say, well, you got to go over to here and it's like the best place and you can get a drink there.
Well, before that, Jack asks,
I have many questions and little time. Who is in charge here? I must speak with your king.
So, Jack.
You don't see Aku. Aku sees you.
And then it zooms out and we see all the advertisements, the street lamp, everything is Aku flavored. And we get this amazing billboard where Aku's eating a sandwich. You know, in perpetuity, just eating that sandwich in the advertisement.
Even though he doesn't eat anything. It's like, Aku doesn't eat. He doesn't sleep. He doesn't drink. He's a demon.
I mean, like, he's making a really evil face. Like, there's something real evil about eating that sandwich.
And isn't that what you want to aspire to be? Just like Aku. But not too powerful, or he'll kill you.
Yeah, really quickly.
So they have, you know, they're looking around and everything is Aku. I mean, it's like, it's a twisted version of those future cities that you see in like Blade Runner or Fifth Element or any of those other metropolises in pulp fiction or pulp sci-fi where it's all billboards everywhere. Except this is just monolithic. Everywhere is just Aku. It's not, oh, Atari over here and Braun over there. It's all right. Aku. So they're like, okay, well, where can I get a drink? Oh, this place over there, it's the best. You should go over there. Now, I'm pretty sure they weren't working for Aku or anything like that. That's where they happen to be hanging out.
And that's clearly where they go to get a drink. They saw Jack making that weird face while he struggled with his own sanity. And
yeah, the poor...
And they're like...
Jack's face is just...
Jack, you look like you need a drink.
You need a drink. Oh, hell yeah, I would too.
Yeah.
If I were thrown thousands of years into the future. And he's like sweating and the look on his face is like... he can't even... Like, this is what Aku did for his revenge.
Yep.
What did Aku do? He didn't kill Jack. He didn't throw him through space. He threw him through time.
He sealed him away.
The despair that Jack feels from beholding this ruin that became of what he did. He didn't kill Aku right away like his father told him to. Or he didn't plant him. Again, he hesitated in killing him. And Aku was like, nope, into the future. And the same despair his father probably felt.
Yep.
Watching everything being torn down, Jack now feels seeing everything built up.
Mm-hmm.
So he sees all of this city built up as Aku, not watching his empire destroyed. It's the same effect.
Yep.
Horrible, horrible disconnection and disaffectation and, oh my God, what have I done? It's all in his face. And he had pretty good control of himself. He gave himself a good, like, 5 seconds to freak out. And then his training kicked in. And he was like, okay, I need to deal.
Yep. And where am I? You know, they tell him he needs a drink and perhaps I do. He goes over and what appears to be three people enter the nightclub door.
What do you want?
A few of the locals inform me that I might be able to refresh myself here.
What?
Hey, man! Jack just want a drink!
A drink? Why didn't you say so?
And then again he gets helped by these guys standing over next to the bar just...
I mean, when the trash thing came through, it's possible they were just waiting for it to pass. Maybe they're scavengers. Maybe, like, sometimes there's interesting things down there in the junk that they could pick up or trade in so they can go get a drink. Like, it's not, it's kind of like those dudes that used to go around cities and picking up cans.
But yeah.
Like, there was, I remember seeing this, there were some homeless people that were actually, that was their job after a while. They would just walk around the city picking up aluminum cans and taking it, walking it back to the recycling center, which would take them hours and hours to walk across town to get this. But they were picking up, you know, a couple hundred bucks a day, picking up thousands of cans.
My dad did that, and he wasn't homeless.
Yeah, there's people who do junk. Our next door neighbor does this. He's a junker. Like, he's just got an old beat up pickup truck. He drives around looking for washing machines.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's actually taken things from my yard before.
These dudes don't look like they're that particular. Like, it's not their job because they're dressed fairly well. They're not dirty in any sense. You know, the dude has a really cool, what did you call it?
A lava lamp.
It's a lava lamp hat.
Yeah, that's kind of great.
I thought it was his brain. Like, no, his head would fit under that. Okay, that's a hat. But they're also clearly organic. They can't afford any augmentations. They're obviously kind of poor. They live in the lowest level. What do they say? The lowest level of the central hub, which is the worst industrial residential place in the city. Which is like, okay, residential, industrial. That is the most horrible combination. Any city planner or anyone who's ever played anything like Civilization or anything like any city planning game is immediately facepalming when they hear that, like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Industrial, residential. That's super.
But I mean, that's a perfect description of what we got there. Mm-hmm. Bars, people hanging out on the side of the street, and there's trash everywhere.
Trash everywhere.
And there's, you know, factories belching out smoke. Yeah, residential, industrial.
And so Jack is finally let into the bar because they're like, yo, he just wants a drink.
Why didn't you say so?
Yeah. Closes up the thing, lets Jack in, and he is assaulted.
Yeah.
By incredible club music. It's going crazy.
Yeah, I love the way they showed it because his ears start to just, like, pulse with the music. And he covers them up. That's really what it's like. The first time you hear loud concert or club music, you hear just like, whoa. Like,
I've never
experienced
anything
really
like
intense.
So he wades into this incredible, overwhelming, dancers everywhere, flashing lights, weird aliens. He can't stop looking at them.
It's a weird alien cantina scene.
Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, and we've seen those in other movies before, most notably
Star Wars.
Star Wars,
yep. Yeah. And we'll see again that Star Wars is sort of harkened back to a couple times here.
At least two times. So, you know, as is usual for any adventurer entering a cantina for the first time on an adventure, there's a bar fight. And it's started by a weird-looking lizard dude who doesn't like the way he's looking at him.
Yeah, Jack wastes no time getting into a conflict with an angry lizard folk. And, of course, you know,
lizard folk.
in a flash, we've already gone back to Star Wars Episode 4 and chopped the guy's arm off after saying you didn't want to start anything.
This little one isn't worth your trouble. Now let me buy you a drink.
Yep. Yeah,
and no Obi-Wan this time. He is the Obi-Wan.
Yep.
And the Luke. And so, basically, dude tries. He has this weird, very inefficient looking extensible sword.
Yep.
And Jack is just trying to back out of the argument. I don't want to fight. Look, you guys,
you know,
this is your place. I just walked into it.
I apologize for my transgression.
Yeah, very honorable in Japanese. Just exactly the way he was trained. And of course, the big guy is, well, it's a human.
Yep. He doesn't take that too lightly. And so he attacks, and like I said, his hand gets chopped off, and almost immediately, every other lizard person in the whole cantina shows up. Clearly, they, you know, they've got a lot of lizard folk solidarity, because immediately backup shows up.
And it's like they were keeping track of this, like, oh, you mess with one of us, you mess with all of us.
Yep.
They're my gang. They're my group. And that also makes sense in sort of a shady underground area. You'd want to have your little, your clan, your posse, your whatever you want to call them, to have your back. And they all try to gang up on him. And Jack's kind of very sad about this. Like, I don't want to fight. What the?
Yep.
Fine. You know, dude tries to slash at him. Jack isn't there. he's coming up over his head, and it's this awesome comic book frame, and it goes to commercial. And when it comes back, it ensues this great fight scene,
yep,
where he's like cutting off limbs, and he's still trying to be ethical. As soon as he realizes, yeah, what he cut off wasn't an organic limb, like he didn't, he, yeah, couldn't see a way to disarm them, but he literally disarmed them.
Yeah, and I mean, here we go again with the rockets. They have rockets in their fingers. Their fingers are rockets,
which are allowed in the bar somehow.
They literally tried to finger bang him.
Oh my god. That's true. Have some finger missiles.
Yeah, so, you know, he dodges that.
So they're not moving any faster than arrows at this range, yep, and for their power. So he's just jumping around and missing them the way he's been trained to do.
Right.
And he's still not, like, beheading them, or he's still just cutting off their arms. He's keeping them from hurting him or anyone else in the bar.
Yeah, and we noticed that a few tiny canine archaeologists have taken interest in this brawl and are placing bets on who's going to come out on top, with our Scottish Terrier betting on the side of the lizard folk, and
it's not over yet. Yeah. And then they're like, but I think he's doing quite well. Look at him, you know. As he's fighting through, they already talked to one mercenary dude.
Oh yeah,
pretty much told him to fuck off. You know, I'm not going against that coup. Are you crazy?
Well, I mean, he didn't say it in English, but when the Scottish Terrier translated, it didn't sound too good.
Yeah,
he basically figures anybody who tries to fight Aku is mad.
Mm-hmm. And, well, they were. Nothing of this world hurts him.
Yep.
So they're like, well, we need to find a way to, you know, we're trying to get this thing done, and we've asked just about everybody here, and this is the mean, it's implied, this is the meanest bar we could find.
Yep.
Like, they look like they're men of leisure.
Yeah, it doesn't look like they belong in this cantina, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. Why would a dog go to a humanoid strip club in the first place? Like,
well, it was only about 60% humanoid. The rest was a mishmash of weird looking things in the background. Which is, I think there's something cool about this too. When you look at a modern sci-fi cartoon like Rick and Morty, you can see where Rick and Morty drew from this.
Yeah.
Because at the time, they were being impressionistic with Samurai Jack. They were trying to keep animation costs down. It was still hand drawn, most of it. They were still trying to keep the look of the show to be this impressionistic painting.
Right.
Whereas something like Rick and Morty is like, Blu-ray moments.
Yeah.
Like everywhere in Rick and yep. Morty, there's Blu-ray moments constantly, everything. I mean, the one that strikes me that comes to mind immediately is when they're having a big house party with all the people. Yep. I don't remember what episode it is, but they're having a big alien house party at Rick's house, and there's this blue blob at the party talking thing, and it's like, he's only on screen for like a couple of seconds, but if you freeze it, you can make out all the little shapes the blob has picked up or absorbed. And there's like, you know, a camera and a dildo.
Yep.
But like, they put little things as much as they can like that in Samurai Jack also. This probably goes back to giving the storyboard people so much power in how the story was written. So they're watching Samurai Jack absolutely wipe the floor with these robotic lizard men. And, you know, they had to do it. Kids cartoon. Of course, there's no flesh being cut. But again, right, the sword has no problem going through any of this. Yep. Nothing. There's no force fields on it. There's no super alien metal that they're made of. Boom. Done.
So we see the canine archaeologists come over and, well, at least the apparent leader comes over and tries to talk Jack into joining them for a drink. And we see...
Down here, old fella. I was just wondering if you would be so kind as to join us, as we are...
Talking demon dogs.
Good heavens, where?
You will not best me this day, vile henchman of Aku.
Hold on a moment, sir. I am by no means a demon, or have anything to do with Aku.
But you speak in the language of man.
But of course. You're not from around here, are you?
You know, after a brief explanation that, no, in fact, he is not a demon, he convinces Jack to come over at least for a free explanation on what's going on.
And
you know,
there are actually other tropes about talking dogs too. Talking dog tropes go back, well, at least to the 60s for Mr. Peabody. Remember the old Bullwinkle show had the little smart time traveling dog? So there's like, he time traveled to find a dog. And here's a talking dog. So that's it. You know, it's super smart. It's not just a talking dog, not just the way that a doggo would talk in a meme, but he's actually quite eloquent. And they, again, shortcut that in Hollywood terms by let's give him a British accent, because the other two didn't have. Well, one was a Scottish terrier and had a Scottish accent naturally.
Yep.
And the other one was clearly like a dopey American hound.
Yep.
But they were different doggy nationalities. They all had different doggy accents. And all of them were quite intelligent because they were all archaeologists. They were studied men of leisure. And this was an unaccustomed place for them to be. But hey, they happen upon a human who has the same level of elocution, the same level of intelligence. And oh my God, this is the person we need. And for them, after however long they've been doing this for, years of trying to find somebody to help them with this.
Yeah.
They come across Jack. This is the first time he has to help. And you watch that decision. They lay out their history here about how, you know, how long have you been here for? And, they get drinks. First of all, they get drinks. Yeah.
Sit down, have a drink and exposition, please.
Dog's position. And, naturally, like dogs, they lap their drinks. That was pretty funny. And, oh, I'm so sorry. We haven't introduced ourselves.
This is Sir Dreyfus Alexander, Chief of Excavation. Dreyfus, old boy, you're drooling again.
Sorry.
You blasted idiot! You're getting everybody wet!
And this fine gentleman is Angus McDuffie, artifact aficionado. And I am Sir Colin Bartholomew Montgomery Rothschild III. Or Rothy, for short.
I'm sorry. I'm very confused. Your world is new to me. What has happened?
And they use some sort of doggo smellometer to determine that he comes from 25 BA, or before Aku.
Yeah, and I noticed as we were looking at that the meter that they were using to judge his time, I guess his proper date, it only goes up to 9,999, which means that if he's 25 years before the highest year on there, we can assume that the very oldest that he could possibly be would be, let's see, 10,024. The longest period of time during which we could say he's been sent forward would be 10,024. Now, it's very likely that it's not that.
I get the impression it's like 3,000.
But we do know 3,000. It's not. It only goes up to the 1,000th, you know, place.
9,999.
Yeah.
There's only four decimal places for it to go to. But if he has a little smello thing that goes over his nose where he's like, it comes up on the thing for what it is.
And, like, and we'll include a picture because it's kind of perfect.
Yeah, it's great. But, you know, they're giving him this exposition about, well, dogs have always been able to talk. We have this theory that they weren't ever able to. And Jack says, well, yeah, they were great companions, but they would.
All I ever knew were dogs that barked.
And they're like, oh, Revelation, you see, I was right. Only dogs bark. Dogs only bark. This is like mystery of the pyramid level for them.
Oh, yes.
They're trying to find out who they are, and Aku has erased everybody's records and kept everybody from knowing who they are.
Right.
Very obviously. So, you know, he's going to help them figure more out. He's going to help them find out more what happened to dogkind back then, which really only happened a few years after Jack left.
Oh, yeah. You know, actually, it's funny because pretty much as soon as Jack agrees to help them, we see the Triclops waitress clock out of work.
No, well, before that, we see the moment that Jack does this, where they ask him for his help and he closes his eyes and he makes the good choice.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we watch him considering, like, do I really want to involve myself with this?
Right. I really need to get to the past.
I need to get back to the past. I need to defeat Aku back there. And it's this enormous drive immediately on his face. Like, this place confuses me. I hate it. I need to get back. But these people need my help.
Right.
And his morals and ethics step up and say, okay, I'll help you. Like, he makes the hero's choice at that point. He could have walked away. These were quest givers. He could have just walked out of the bar. And he chose the quest. And that, I think, is indicative of, like, who Jack is to his core. He accepts, just like his father did, he accepts responsibility. These are his people.
Yep.
These dogs come from, you know, the line of this human race, or this race of creatures, intelligent creatures from Earth. From Earth dogs comes from his time.
I'm not sure he sees them as being the same as him yet. But at this point, he at the very least says, These are familiar faces. These are something I know.
They're friendly.
And they want my help, and they've already helped me.
Mm-hmm.
So he agrees to help them. And like I said, we see the waitress clock out and immediately...
Susie Triclops.
Yeah. Immediately goes to tell Aku that there was a guy committing copyright infringement against Disney in her bar.
It was Disney now. It used to be Lucasfilm. Yeah, but yeah.
But either way, we sort of see her immediately make this decision, which I think is interesting because, look, it's one weird guy in a specific bar in the entire city, and it's a waitress. As soon as she hears something, even the slightest bit odd, she immediately goes and tells Aku, hey, there's this one weird guy in this one bar in this one city.
I think she was a paid informant. I think she was supposed to be there. Like, her reason for being there as a waitress or a dancer was to keep her eyes open for any weird things happening and anything that might upset Aku or change anything that he's doing. But this guy, she just watched him, A, walk into the bar from nowhere. B, he's a natural human.
Yeah, I
hardly saw any natural humans there at all. Maybe the three people outside could be called natural human, but they were still a little weird.
Yeah, I mean, one of them's orange, one of them's green, one of them's blue.
Like some kind of a hybrid of an alien, or maybe they're aliens. Yeah. We don't know. But Jack is the only flesh-colored, human-shaped, actual human to walk in.
Right.
Weird thing number one. Weird thing number two, he just wiped the floor with a dozen huge lizard mercenaries who obviously no one was fucking with in that bar.
Yeah.
Nobody was around there. Nobody got in their face. Those guys,
each of those lizards had an entourage of his own.
Yeah. They were obviously powerful gangster type people at that level. And Jack casually wipes the floor with them. With three, a sword, a magical sword that wasn't electrical. It didn't glow. It wasn't a laser sword of any sort. It was a katana. It was a piece of metal. The simplest weapon that was in that bar. They were firing missiles at him, and he took them out. So I think that's probably enough for an informant to go, hey, boss, this is weird. You want to take a look at this?
Yeah.
You know, obviously, Aku's got a bunch of stuff that he's keeping suppressed, and he can look at things very quickly based on what we've seen just in a few scenes. But this is enough for any informant to go to any boss monster and say, this is weird. This guy is powerful. He's at the very least going to disrupt your operations.
Yeah. But before she can tell him, she has to wait her turn.
Mm-hmm.
Because.
Oh, but she moves through the city and you start seeing more of the city and what it is. So she, and it's great animation here. They just make her, they don't move any feet or anything. She's just a little black blob moving along.
Yep.
So they get some some frames and save on animation. And when she goes up in an elevator and you start to see the cityscape. And what's the cityscape?
It's filled with Aku and things shaped like Aku's head.
It's another Aku's forest.
Yep.
Except this time, instead of weird spiritual antennas, it's buildings. And they're all shaped like, I wonder if that's a part of the building code. Like, no building will be built that doesn't look like me, no matter how inefficient.
Right, yep.
So she obviously gets into something technological. This is a teleportation unit, and it's way up on top of the building, accessible only by an elevator that only she seems to be able to get into. So this is very obviously people in the know how to get to the teleporter.
Yep.
This is not down in the low streets. This
Although,
is on top of a building.
Even as we looked at the city, we can see that not everyone's been given a living space. And like you said, it's so labyrinthian and so cluttered, because even in between the buildings, we see people have sort of pieced together homes out of scrap metal and stuff, and it's sort of just built off of whatever they can handle, you know, well, whatever it can hang off of.
It's a residential industrial area.
Yeah.
That's what happens. Like, wherever you can find a niche, that's where you weld together your whatever crap they can find in the gutter that they just put together for their little niche, their little place that they can feel at least safe enough to sleep. And they're just kind of stuck everywhere.
Yeah, bare minimum dwelling.
Mm-hmm. So she hops into the local teleporter and whoosh, disappears.
Yep. And when she reappears, we see she's surrounded by... Oh, you actually had mentioned the name of the race.
Oh, the...
My lord, we are the Vanaplas from the Mosconian galaxy. Our water planet has been pillaged, and all the oceans that were once our home are gone. We have searched long and hard to find a planet with oceans rich enough to sustain our people. and your world is our last hope for survival.
They plead. Aku, yeah, they plead for his help because their home planet has been pillaged and it's unlivable now. And we see Aku appear in his typical, incredible, dramatic entrance. And he says,
I know of your plight, Badaquian, for you see, I am he who has taken your water and the riches within them.
Mwahaha.
And we have the leader's son come up and say, you monster!
You monster! Be quiet!
I am sorry, my lord. The boy is young and foolish. He does not know what he says.
The boy will return. He will learn proper respect for Aku in the pit of hate.
Yes, O master, your wisdom is unquestionable.
And we have to accept that he's just a kid despite him having that bushy mustache.
Eyeballs and a mustache. They're almost like seeing enemies on the end of a stalk. Like,
yeah.
And the little helmets have a little microphone underwater. And then there's little wavies at the top. You can tell these are spacesuits with a water containment unit, not,
Aku agrees to help them, but only if they will once a month build a large enough statue of Aku to have it rise up out of the ocean from the ocean floor. Now, the likelihood, even with them being an advanced spacefaring race, of them being able to every month create a statue large enough to reach the surface from the bottom of the ocean every month is very low.
Yeah.
What he's done is he's taken their home and offered them a new ocean in exchange for permanent slavery. They will spend all of their time now building stone statues of Aku.
I don't think he specifies what they need to be made out of, but yeah. They have to remind everyone flying over or sailing past that area of Aku. Again, puts his image out everywhere. It's the same thing he was doing with the evil forest antennas.
Yep.
I mean, remember when I said I saw that, it felt uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's meant to remind you of his evil at all times. Whatever little bit of despair that people tend to get by beholding him, he feeds off of it.
Yeah, I mean, we got the omnipresent ads, the totem poles, the signs with his horns on them, whole races from entire planets made to build statues of him on Earth. Aku went from something we barely understand, something that's hard for us to understand as an alien threat, and he's become something much more familiar. Anyone living in modern times would recognize the evil that he represents here. We've all sort of experienced this kind of oppression, although to scale, I doubt.
Not to that scale, no.
But, this is a much more familiar Aku. After these thousands of years, he's changed in a way that makes him familiar for humans. Although that's not the majority of his inhabitants anymore. And what we hear him say to these aliens makes it seem like he's renamed the planet Aku. These are the oceans of Aku.
Yeah, this world, my world.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if we'll see later that the planet has been renamed Aku, because he referred to it as the Oceans of Aku, which really makes you wonder if he has sort of, every time he contacted an outside race, he said, this is Aku, you know?
Was he naming it as a personal possession, or was he naming it as a place name?
Yeah
we don't really catch that from context.
But it should be interesting as we go on to see if they make any more allusion to that. Because I know we encounter some other alien races and we see him speaking to other alien races.
And we've seen how his oppression has affected those races. I mean, we're already seeing at least two of them in this episode. Not just the general repression of poverty and stuff that he's throwing everyone in the industrial residential section into. Like, we're seeing, like, the dogs are being repressed and the poor Wadaquians are being repressed.
Yeah, so we see Aku sends the boy to the pit of hate. And we've heard it described that that's where he came from. That tar pit is what I'm assuming they're talking about. But if they're saying the pit of hate to mean hell, which we'll see the gods refer to him as an evil from the pit of hate later. So could it be that he is referring to hell? Because this boy has been sent there, wherever it is, to learn respect for Aku.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting to see if we learn a little bit more about what that means, where he sent them.
The teleportation that the informant goes through is technological. The teleportation that his amazing flaming eye beams did was supernatural. So it would seem likely that given a supernatural means of teleportation, he could send him someplace supernatural.
Yep.
We could see the Pit of Hate being very similar to what we saw when Jack returned from his journeys with the humans working and mining and doing useless stuff. Like, I think it's meant to kind of call back to that. But again, like, you're right. How advanced is that now after thousands of years of refinement? Humans and intelligence, as we understand it, has shaped Aku so that his mode of harvesting misery has had to fall into line of what is the best way to induce misery with these particular life forms.
Right.
And when we see the kind of misery he does, there's like these layers to it, whether he meant to do it or not.
Right.
Like, there's personal layers to it. Like, they're inviting mercenaries and things here, and they're horrible bars, and people spy on each other and stuff.
Yep.
And then there's this industrial level of repression, and then there's this political level of repression.
And so, even, like, we see in the following scene, resource, he just dominates every resource on the planet. It's all his.
Mm-hmm.
Even stuff that really, sometimes he just takes stuff like the water planet, and it doesn't mean anything to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Whatever. I need water for whatever it is that I'm doing here.
Yep.
And there it goes.
Yep.
And so they're from another, I'm not sure if they were just like not being astronomically accurate, but they say they're from the Muscomian galaxy.
Yeah. Which,
like, wait a minute. There are like 100 billion star systems in this galaxy alone.
Yeah. If we're suggesting that one, he dominated their planet on that other galaxy, and two, that he dominated that galaxy on such a scale that the nearest place with survivable water was Earth, that in order to find a place to live left in any galaxy, they had to come to Aku's planet.
Or at least in their galaxy, and we might have been the closest one.
Yeah.
And maybe that's Andromeda, that's Pegasus, we don't know.
It's wild to think that it's possible that he took over not just all the planets in our galaxy, but all the planets in that one, so that there's no place with clean water left except
for what Aku gives them.
Right.
So in this case, this might be, when I watched this, the first thing that occurred to me was, where are the gods?
Oh, yeah.
Because the gods came in and mowed the hedges last time evil got out of control. And they just ruthlessly waded in and burned it out. And the tiny mistake they made allowed Aku to come in and plant himself and eventually win, basically.
Yep. And it's interesting to note, for some reason, we see them strangely absent, and his domination has gone across galaxies now. So what's going on? Where are they? And I was thinking it was possible that because he's dominating these other planets, not with his magic or with his own incredible power, just spreading himself out the way he did as a more primal evil, since he himself is not present, then his magic is not present in whatever's going on in those other galaxies. Is it possible that they simply aren't detecting that it's him? Maybe it's just his vast galactic organization that's doing this, you know? And so for the gods' perspective, it's not much of an evil presence, or really a magical evil presence.
It's a technological evil. It's a political evil, but they're not concerned with that.
Evil. Yeah.
They're concerned with existential supernatural threats. That seems to be their mode. And they already did introduce a means to stop it. Maybe that's their rules. We can only introduce a means to stop it one time. There are no other heroes. The gods didn't throw any other heroes at him in 3,000 years or whatever.
It's
no one has risen to face
that, him. They put the weapon on the planet and said, look, when somebody is worthy, they'll deal with it. We gave it to the samurai. It was made with his soul. And if he didn't do the job, what more can we do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we gave you the tool, the one thing that can destroy him, and you didn't. So your race, your species is going to have to figure this out. And we will see some of those gods again, and their interaction with Jack is interesting. So, when we get to that episode, it's going to be cool. Mm. So I can't remember what season it's in, but we'll see Ra again specifically. And I think that the way he gets involved and the way that he conducts himself makes me think, like, yeah, you know, you can bring us here and make us pay attention to a very specific problem, but look, we've got celestial things to do.
Yeah, exactly. That it's like it's asking the CEO of a company to sit down and take a credit collection call. Like, it yep. doesn't happen. You know, you hire a drone to do that. Well, and in this case, he's their heroic drone. He's got his sword, and there's the evil. Now yep. you just have to put those two together and kill him.
Yeah, go ahead. Get the job done, or somebody else will. But so we see him conclude his business with the, you know, water people, and he moves on to speaking to this waitress, or I guess secret private investigator, whatever you want to...
Informant. Yeah, I'll call informant. Her an informant. Yeah.
And she says...
My lord master, I have great news for you.
What information can be considered great for the immortal Haku? What impertinence is this? Show me the fool!
And there's Jack.
Yep.
And Aku's like, ugh.
Just as soon as Aku is watching, it's almost as if Jack gets like a chill on his spine or something, because he turns in the exact direction from which Aku is watching him supernaturally, divining him.
Matt, you don't watch Aku. Aku watches you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's true.
Again, with the writing, they just fucking lay it out. Like yep. everything in here, like they just tell you what they just did. Aku watches you. There right. it is. And his first expression is like shock for about 2 or 3 seconds. He's like, oh, and then he gets this very sly look on his face.
So fate has arrived. Many years have gone since that day.
Like, okay, I expected this at some point. I have forgot about it. I've been so busy taking over entire galaxies.
Yep.
And having people build statues of me, you know, winning civilization colon Aku, that I never even remembered I sent this stupid samurai here. Oh, well, since I've already won, it's going to be very hard for him to do anything towards me.
Yep.
But now I know where he's going, and I know who he's going with. So, no problem. Release the drones.
Yeah, and we see him send out a giant army of drones, which was really cool. I really like how they animate the drones in this.
Well, all we see at the end of the episode is a whole bunch of them, but we still have his car ride.
When he first says,
"You will pay for my pain in the past with your pain in the future."
When he says that, a whole bunch of drones start pouring out of the bottom of that weird volcano he lives in. They come out.
Just had some on hand.
Yep.
I missed that part.
And he seems to direct them without speaking a word, which means maybe you're right that his presence is inside of them in some way, because he sends them out without saying anything really as a command, you know, and they just run off. So maybe he really is present, at least some small amount, in each of those drones.
Or they've been programmed to think like him.
Oh, that's
like
true.
He oversaw their initial construction. And, I mean, it makes sense that the first time he saw that technology, he would have done an Aku style,
this will help me suppress even more people.
Right,
like, he would have been delighted to see this technology. It wouldn't have occurred to him to build on his own. It's obviously he got this from aliens. And when he did, he had them built in his image and likeness. You know, to everything about them evokes Aku, the spikiness of them and how they move and stuff. They're almost like a shape he would shapeshift into. And overseeing them being built and building hundreds of them, of course he would want them to be connected to him somehow. So he would have a way of extracting despair from the people he was using them to kill. And it cuts back to the dogs. Pulling along in a rocket car.
Oh, yeah.
And this is the most scared we've ever seen Jack.
Yeah,
and probably the whole series is him shuddering at how fast they're going.
Yeah.
One dog is hanging out the window.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Dogs that can take themselves for a drive. Like
another subtle bit of awesome humor that they throw in. So they finally arrive at where they're getting to, and there's this picture of a ruined city. And apparently there was this online thing about how that's actually the city of Townsville, and that how the somehow the timelines of Powerpuff Girls and Samurai Jack crisscross and
crisscross or at least parallel
or intersect somewhere. It doesn't seem
some hints, but it's hard to really say it is Townsville.
It's sort of a Pixar thing where they throw something in the background, like oh, there's a stuffed Nemo doll on her dresser, and okay, they were doing that for fun. Yeah, they were calling back to it. It probably isn't, but when they get there, you know, they're being told, you know, the sentient dogs were made that way in order to be workers, in order to be in, you know, but we built this city as sentience, and then Aku came and took it over and forced us to mine. And when they land, you start to see some of their archaeological digs at first, and then it gets to where they're mining this crystal, which is grown through everything. If that's the crystal that Aku is using as a power source, if that's one of the main Earthian resources.
Yeah, because if you remember, when Aku's family was being forced to mine these exact same crystals, they said something about it being Jack's a family, source of his power. Yeah.
That might be the source of magic on Earth. That might be something that's like Gaia power somehow. That's the force of supernatural power for Earth. The more he mines, the less supernatural abilities there is, which could be why there's so many robots.
Oh, yeah.
There's, you know, he does run into supernatural things, but they tend to be out in the way. They tend to be like way out.
Or they themselves are like Leviathans. They're giant creatures that are magical because they're like
unto themselves
mythological creatures. Yeah.
But most of the stuff where you see Jack wander, you know, walking the earth like Kane in Kung Fu, he's in places that haven't been despoiled yet, haven't been mined, haven't been overtaken, which makes me wonder why there's any places left on Earth like that. But Aku is basically using these things for power, and he uses the misery of other people to get it. And then he uses that technological power to go, you know, repress more people and get more misery out of it. It's this great circle of awful.
Yeah. I wanted to make a note because you did say something interesting there. So there are a bunch of these beautiful, vast natural environments that haven't been obliterated by Aku. Why? I think Aku's power is almost entirely derived or exists in opposition to biological life. It's there to torment people or intelligences. And those people or intelligences don't want to go, in general, someplace without Wi-Fi. Well, really? I mean, I don't know if you've ever been out in the country before, but... you're going to have a little trouble getting internet. You know,
get one bar in your cell phone, you're lucky.
out there that are advertising dial-up. Like, hey, you know, we're bringing dial-up to this, you know, to this town. If you want to be part of it, sign up now, you know, like.
Yeah.
That's intense, you know, and out there in the middle of that beautiful desert, do you really think anybody would be connected? So.
There's nothing there.
Maybe that there are these big cities where people willingly live surrounded by Aku's incredible evil because, look, modern civilization, that's where life is. For them, you know, why would they want to go out and be hermits? And we do see some races of people who live out in solitude, but in the year 3000, let's say it's 3000 for us.
Okay.
Are we really going to want to isolate ourselves, or do we want to be part of the technological world that's going on? You know, technology to the point where there's flying cars. Would you rather walk around on a camel or ride in a flying car? It's going to be harder and harder as you see time progressing to find people who are like, yeah, I'm happy growing potatoes out in the middle of this godforsaken desert. Like, you know, like,
he doesn't travel through all desert. There's some of the oceans are actually not despoiled yet.
Yeah. We do see some like beautiful valleys with, you know, flowers and such, but, you know, you could find that on the internet. You can just view that. You know, we all have Reddit landscape.
Hey guys, I found this awesome picture of nature.
Wow. Yeah. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful out there. But I live in an urban hellscape, so, you know, but at least there's Wi-Fi and there's really great fast food here, and Aku recommends it.
Yeah, so. I mean, all these pictures are great. I just wish there wasn't this Aku's face watermark over everything. Oh, well, it's probably actually there, you know.
It's Aku's internet.
yeah.
Aku owns it, and there's no net neutrality. And Aku owns everything. I think you're right, though. Like, it's for the same reason that people partake in at least suburban life, if not urban life, is because there are more resources, they can get more done, there are more opportunities.
There's more people.
There's more people around for them to share their misery with. And Aku's ability to sort of harvest the misery, the more people that are there in one location, the easier it is to get from that, and the more he can control that group.
Yeah, I mean, if you'll notice, Aku seems to be directing where people can live when they come to his planet in the first place.
Yeah.
He says, you guys, okay, you're going to live here. And you're going to be in the ocean, and each of you is going to be in this location because I need you to do this one thing. All right. In exchange for being allowed to live here, you're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to build a big old statue of me. It's
the ultimate company town.
You're going to have to make advertisements where I chew on this sandwich over and over again. You know, every person.
And you'll have to use flash animation to do it.
No, we went to college for Adobe.
I don't care.
Exactly. So clearly,
I want controlling shares in flash
clearly
animation.
That's another part of why you don't see so many people living outside of it. I mean, we get a brief glimpse of some weird, like, sauropod alien things.
Yeah, as they're flying, they fly over stuff. The sauropods are one, like, six-legged beast with tents on their back. Like, that's kind of cool. Who are these people? Where do they come from? What are they trading? Why are they traveling?
Yep.
It's just a scene, and they just throw this stuff into the show, and you're left going, that's just unspeakably awesome. And it's an entire arc of shows on its own based on what these things are and answering their questions. Nope, they flew over it.
Yeah, so, you know, there are people out there, but not many, because you're making a choice to live like a hermit out there. And you might find monks that are willing to do that. You might find ancient wizards willing to do that. You might even find, like, people who are mountain climbing enthusiasts out there or something like that. But really, most people are going to want to live in the city. They're going to want that nice Wi-Fi,
especially
or whatever Aku calls it.
Where if they can, maybe the promise of being able to leave this planet for one that isn't quite so repressed by Aku.
That's true, too.
There are some people who buy into the game and think that maybe I'll be, just like in real life, maybe I'll be the one that will win the lottery, or I'll somehow gain Aku's favor, or I'll do well enough to get enough money to get off this rock and go to a different planet, which we see actually later. There's a group that tries to leave the planet. But, when they're flying over, they fly over these huge, immense drilling machines.
Oh,
which is like, you know, obviously.
Oh, and each of the drilling machines has
Aku's head on it.
Yeah.
And they're all in a row. These things are enormous. These things are like Star Wars sized.
Yep.
They're huge. And what's he drilling for? What could possibly need a drill that size to get to? And it's a blasted wasteland around there. Like, maybe when he's having people mining the low-hanging fruit, you know, he has intelligences doing the hard labor in mines to get this crystal out. You know, he's not only mining the crystal for, like I said, for energy, for what he needs it for.
Yeah, it's the torture.
It's the torture that he's also getting off on. Well, once that's done, and you can't really physically send people down anymore, maybe there's crystals that are deeper. And these things can drill faster to get them, but maybe it's not high quality, maybe it's not as often, but, you know, an alien mining contract, sure, go ahead and drill, see what you can find. It's a residual long tail effect of his evil.
Yep.
And meanwhile, it despoils the environment and makes everybody uncomfortable, and they all look like Aku.
Yeah, exactly. The giant drills looking like Aku, I wanted to make a point because, you know, any of us who have jobs, and I know that not everybody does, but you get to a point where if they're treating you halfway decently, you say when you get to work, like, hey, you know, this is my work. This is my job. I'm getting the job done.
There's a bit of gritty pride in anything, even if you're cleaning toilets.
But imagine if your place of work that you were forced to feel at least some amount of pride for getting that job done also looks just like the supreme leader, you know? He's everywhere.
Yeah.
If you're proud of your job, you're proud of Aku.
Yeah. And how many people have bought into that big lie? That willingly do it because it's the only way it's ever been. I mean, look at like you thought North Korea was bad. You know, you thought Stalinist Russia was bad with the iconography. It's
you
like,
see, those three guys that helped Jack at the beginning, they're not living in a good place.
Nope.
But they seem to be eking out some level of joy in that place because at least they have their friends. And again, that's another reason you would want to live in a city, because at least there's someone to relate to instead of just a vast jungle or some, you know, one oasis in the center of a desert where the only thing you're likely to see is cranes and stuff like.
And it's all, there's also something to say here too about community. Like yeah. when we're seeing this, we see.
Oh yeah, even with the sauropod.
There's no communities around, but the sauropods imply one. The dogs have the ruins of one. Yep. The aliens that are visiting Earth, I mean, even the damn lizard guys were yeah. part of a little community. Like, people will still make communities, even under the thumb of a literal demon.
yeah.
People will, you thought any repressive thing was bad from any other dictator. Aku is a literal demon, and they're still forming communities where yep. they have their homies. These are my people.
Yeah.
The street kids did, the lizards did, the dogs did. Everybody had their little local community.
Yeah, I mean, even the triclopses were all working in one building.
True. We didn't see any other. Do we see any other triclopses after that? I think we do.
Probably.
But, I mean, it's easy to think that it's throwaway, but I would think there's at least one other level of depth to that.
Yep.
Like these women who found a place to work without being terribly exploited.
Right.
Like, you know, they're alien women, but it looks like she's biological.
Yep.
It looks like she's just as poor as those street kids are. She doesn't have any Augs.
Yep.
She's a normal biological being. And what kind of power can that being hope to scrabble up? Well, it's what women have done for a long time. They wait tables. They dance. They are overlooked and therefore make good informants in every war ever.
Yep.
And when we see her doing this, I don't think that that makes her evil. The Triclops, Susie Triclops.
No, yeah.
She does this because it's her way to survive.
Yeah.
It's her way of keeping her community safe, her community of other dancer women that are there. Like, everybody has their meanings in their communities and what they're going for.
Even everybody there is in some way working for Aku. There is no ethical consumption under Aku.
No, not at all. But the communities are the people between them. This is what they're doing in order to support the tiny little bit of good that it is to connect with somebody like you. And even the dogs are like this. Like, we want to find out what happened to us. This is our history. This is who we are. And we had this theory that we were once beloved of humans.
Right.
That we were once a critical part of their survival. And now we're mining this stupid crystal in the ruins of our city. By the way, I wanted to kind of segue here. That city had crystals growing out of every which place.
Oh, yeah.
It is my thought from this, and we'll see if this proves out in the rest of the series, that this particular kind of power crystal that he's mining is A, supernatural, and B, mm-hmm. grows on its own. It's possible that the dog city was run on it for a while. That they right. did figure out its technology, and it was so far away. I mean, they used a rocket car to get there.
Yeah.
For a long time. So this was way far away from the spaceport, from Hub City or whatever.
Yeah, this is the central hub.
It looked like they actually had 100 years or 200 years to actually build up a little bit. And that would have been possible if the power of these crystals empowered their technological civilization.
Right.
Because we see diggers that dig like a dog, you know?
yeah.
Front paws. Like, okay, I know what kind of power it takes to run. So I have a friend that knows how to operate heavy machine equipment, bulldozers and even bobcats. And it takes a tremendous amount of energy, either sealed up in hydrocarbons or whatever these crystals do.
Right.
It could be that these crystals are a renewable resource over time, that even if humans in the natural course of things had depleted them or had used all the magic in an area or had mined them all out,
right.
even a few that remained would still have grown. And over yep. the centuries, we'll have pushed up to the surface, and oh, now there's more magic again. Like, that's just something that the Earth produced in this particular timeline.
Yeah.
So it looks as if the city was abandoned for a long time, and when Aku finally got around to basically enslaving the dogs, and it's like, oh, look, I just found out through the dogs that this place has an incredible cache of power crystals. Oh, wouldn't it be marvelously, ironically evil
yep.
to send them back to mine crystals from their destroyed city and give
yep,
them to me.
Exactly.
How demoralizing is that? So we fly by both their dig pits where they were doing their archaeology, and one of them had a fire hydrant in it.
Yeah.
They're passing by, oh, these billboards and monuments were all something that we had. And they get to the pit and it's got a fire hydrant in it.
Yeah, you know. Valuable offer.
Valuable for a dog, yeah. And, you know, when they get out of the thing and start walking the rocket car, and Jack's like, I prefer to walk.
Oh dear, Sir Jack, are you ill?
I'm fine. I just prefer walking.
Oh, yes, rocket rides and such. Sorry about that, old-timer. But anyway, welcome to our camp.
Yeah, and that's another good point, is here we see Jack come out. He's now experienced, you know, real-powered vehicular travel. And, he didn't enjoy it too much, and we won't see him really using too many vehicles throughout the series. And I think that
he'll use vehicles that are based on human power, natural power. He'll take a ship, he'll ride in a cart, he'll walk most of the time. He'll ride on the back of something.
But we don't see too much rocket travel or anything like that. And I think that really explains why we usually open up in this show on a scene of Jack walking. And even if he's traveling across the whole planet, he'd still rather just walk.
And he travels light. He's, again, that hero bubble around him means he's unaffected by the elements very often. That he's unaffected by hunger and thirst for as many calories as he might be burning fighting these things. He doesn't seem to eat like a Viking. He eats like an Eastern person. You know, a little bowl of rice, a couple of pieces of fish. You know, it's delicious, and it's a portion.
Those of you, if you've seen Season 5, we do see a little bit more of that explained, you know, sort of him cooking squirrels and stuff like that. But, you know, that's still, come on, that's not that many calories.
I know, like, that's not enough to power a warrior. Yeah. Not enough to power spending 3,600, 4,000 calories walking, and then another 1,500 calories in intense combat that he's slicing these things in half for a long time in some
cases. I mean, they are solid metal. You're swinging through it. Let's say you've got a monomolecular blade made by gods.
I was going to say.
Come on. It's still going to be rough. You're still not cutting through metal.
Yeah.
Come on.
That's the magic part of
it. Yeah. He's using a lot of energy no matter what, though, is what I'm saying.
Like, even if it cuts through effortlessly, like it's not there, if he only gets a little bit of resistance, he's still running through the fighting forms that he uses.
Oh, right.
He's still running through these fighting forms. That's still a lot of work to go. They're designed to build your muscles while you're running the form and get used to the weight and holding the sword. Any martial weapon probably is like that. But when he's doing it, it's burning off a lot. He's jumping around and using these. So he doesn't eat a whole lot that we can see. He doesn't get damaged by a whole lot. He's never really that too hot. He's never really too cold. So Jack as a hero is definitely one of those leveled heroes with the Hollywood bubble. Like, that seems to be proven. The only thing that really scares him is rocket cars. Aku possibly children.
Failure scares
him.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think we see just about every time it looks like he actually won't be able to win, we see him start to lose his cool, you know? His hair flares out in a way that's sort of to show you that he's frazzled now.
Every time they max him out, every time they give him a challenge that pushes him, he gets frazzled a bit until he figures out what I need to do to get past this particular enemy.
And
every enemy teaches him something.
There are enemies that he has lost to that he should have stopped and said, you won, you know? And he doesn't, which is another part that, hey, in certain ways, Jack is not yet as worthy as his father was. There are times that we see him, and we'll get into that especially when it happens, where he should clearly see that he's lost, but he says, I can't give up. I won't give up. And he charges, screaming and swinging wildly, and loses. So there are times when Jack shows why he failed in the first battle. He's so sure that he's fought his whole life. Darn it, he's the greatest warrior ever. You know, how am I not winning? And instead of being humble in that moment, he just tries to go crazy. So, so when we get to those episodes where he doesn't accept his own, like, limitations.
Yeah, we can get into that then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we see the city of the dogs digging, then Jack is horrified. Cause this reminds him, he says out loud, this reminds me of what I saw about a day ago. Back in my own time, my own people were being treated like this. Aku is still doing it. And he sees, you know, little kid dog hauling all this crystal and like misery around him.
Yep.
He's like, I have to help these people. I made the right choice. I have to help these people. And as soon as he beholds this, right on cue, a little messenger dog runs up and says,
They're coming! They're coming! King! Aku's drones approach from the south! They will be upon us by sunrise!
Carpet of evil, destructive Aku bugs coming towards them.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the interesting things about this is, at this point, now we definitely know Jack sees these dog people as his people.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, I've seen this method before.
Yeah.
You know, this is exactly what he did to me, and I'm not going to let this continue. Even though, if he ever succeeds in his goals, this will never have happened anyways. Getting involved on this one is strictly emotional thing for
me. We can get into the entire, to his incredibly, you know, under stress for getting this. Like, the only goal should be getting back in time. Don't give a crap about the people who get you there. You have to be a little bit sociopathic. Your only goal is going back in time so that none of this will have ever happened. But a couple of times he fails on that too, but that's later. Yeah. One other thing I'd like to throw in at the end, and it cuts to the end. It closes on Jack's amazing samurai eyes.
Yep.
His grimace of determination. I will not let this happen. Here's something I can
cut. That look in his eyes, by the way, is the one that they use in the closing where they're like, "Wacha! Wacha!" And we see the eyes. That's the exact, like, look on his face from that little "wacha" thing.
Yeah. But he knows he can take him. He's seen what his sword can do to robots. Like, he knows that it's possible. It's just going to be really hard.
It's a lot of them.
This is like the Superman problem. This is something he can punch. He can't stop the overall evil, but he can punch the robots. And looks like he's kind of looking forward to it. I can vent myself on these things. I can go crazy because this is a physical and horrible immediate manifestation of Aku's evil that are threatening a thing that I have bought into, that I'm going to. And the other thing I wanted to mention at the end, Jack's aplomb in dealing with different intelligences. Different alien viewpoints. He didn't want to have to when he got there, but he dealt with, let's see, 1, 2, at least 3 different alien kind of viewpoints since he got there.
Yep.
Part of the subtlety of his training was teaching him how to deal with different cultures.
That's true.
By its nature, he had to adjust every 2 or 3 years to a brand new culture, of which some things were the same and some things were different, depending on what those cultural values were.
Yep.
So Jack had to adjust to the Egyptians. Jack had to adjust to the Greeks and adjust again when he got to England and Russia. And all this time he had to learn to deal with and excel in these cultures in order to learn what he needed to learn for his training. So fitting right in and observing and watching what they do and seeing what the basics are seemed to be as much a part of his training as learning how to ride a horse or use a bow staff or an arrow, or a bow and arrow. Like, he looked into this and went, these dogs are people. These aren't just helpful little barking companions. These are people who are suffering.
Right.
They built a goddamn city bigger than anything I've ever seen in my life. Even the Grand Imperial City wasn't this big.
Yep.
And these dogs did it? Like, they're intelligence. They're people. They're another culture that I've just encountered, just like the other ones that I trained with my whole life.
Yeah.
So Jack's jumping into it may be seen without forethought as, oh, well, he just goes along with it. Why did he do that? Because it feels familiar. Because entering into a new culture with a set goal in mind while being involved in that culture is something he's done.
Yep.
Since he was a little kid. So, when we end on this, it's kind of a cliffhanger. Like, here's the next danger for the next thing. It flows very much into that in the next episode. But I really enjoyed this one. It's very dense. Like, letting the storyboard people put all the story on screen. I mean, there's a lot of exposition when they're talking, when the dogs are doing their Great British Explorer thing.
Yep.
And, I made a joke earlier, like, where are they getting the money for all of this? Oh, well, obviously, their leader is a Rothschild. It's the richest family in the world.
The Rothschild.
He's a Rothschild. He's a man of means. He has money. So he's the one funding the expeditions. And might be why he's, you know, why he wasn't captured and thrown in to do the mining.
Well, honestly, look at what... You remember when he introduced his two friends? They both had an archaeological specialization.
Uh-huh.
But when he describes himself, he just says his name, which means there's a good chance that you're right.
He's the money.
He's the... he's the backer, the financial backer.
I might even want to say he's not from Earth. He might have been as part of the dogs that got out, you know, and traveled elsewhere.
Who knows?
When he came back, he saw this and went, I can't let this happen.
I mean, the dog can drive a rocket ship.
Sure.
All right, so it's possible.
All bets are on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although, that's another thing I wanted to point out. Like, these may not just be talking dogs as much as they are dog-like humanoids. Because
they're uplifted dogs. They're dogs with intelligence. So they still have these little instincts form how they talk to each other and what they do, like lapping out of a cup or putting a smellometer on their nose. Like, that's how they interact with the world.
But the thing is, we see them using tools and machines that clearly you would need hands for. In fact, we see them carrying things in their hands. So they, I mean, in a mere, what, 2,000 years?
I want to say for our particular canon, it's been 3.
Okay.
That's my safe space.
We'll say 3,000. They've changed a lot, probably because of that magic we were talking about. So definitely some interesting things have been going on with these dogs. It's probably a little weird. But hey, dogs are man's best friend. He's probably been compelled to sort of hang around them from the moment he realized they were not demons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dogs are friendly. Dogs are companions. I need to help them.
And now that he sees them like this, we're going to see pretty sure in the next episode, he's taking them on, you know, almost like he sees them as a part of the family, similar to the way that humans treat dogs now.
Yeah.
Cause he'll, I think this is the next episode is the one where he makes that awesome banner. And, we'll get into that when we get there. But, I think this is where we see Jack says, all right, you know what? You know, you could sleep on the bed. Like, you know, he likes him now, you know? So
that's about right.
We'll see how they collaborate. And I remember they come back in season 5. So we're looking at important characters here now.
I'm excited for this because it not only kicks this off really well, it jumps right into the action. It gives us just enough backstory to get Jack moving in this world. And it sets up, as you said, so much later on. Other than that, I think I've pretty much cleared most of my ideas and how this sets up the Jack universe and who's in it.
I also wanted to mention, just as an interesting note, we've seen in each of the prior episodes, so episode 1, this episode 2 and the following episode were actually originally presented as a movie, a 3-part single story.
Oh, okay.
And that's why it feels like they move right into each other so cleanly.
Good writing, too.
Yep, exactly. It's because it was meant to sort of, this is the opening story, get your bearings here. So, you know, bearings. Anybody want a bearing?
They're delicious and they fit together real neatly and they roll. So I
really like it, and we're almost done with that as a starting point,
as an arc.
Yep, and we'll continue obviously all the way through. But I think this is where we get to know the sort of the flavor of Samurai Jack.
He's definitely got his own flavor. I don't think there's any other hero that's been put through quite what Jack has through the course of this. So with that, I believe we are at a point where we can safely wrap up this episode at this point.
Yep. Well, I'm Matt.
And what is my name again? I'm Andy. Right. I'm Andy, and
thanks for listening to the Back Jack, the Samurai Jack Rewatch Podcast.
And we will catch you again for season 1, episode 3, entitled The First Fight. See you later, guys.
See ya.
Got some thoughts about the show you gotta get off your chest? Are we completely wrong, or do you love the podcast with a burning passion? Why not let us know? Contacting Andy and Matt is easy. Find us on Facebook. Email us at backjackpodcast@gmail.com. See our notes and reference links over at backjackblog.wordpress.com. Shoot us a tweet at backjackpodcast. And listen directly at, you guessed it, backjack.podomatic.com. That awesome Samurai Jack music remix that you've heard was done by Musicality Music, and you can check out the rest of his stuff at www.musicalitymusic.net. Backjack the Samurai Jack Rewatch Podcast is a Ninja White Star production.